This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisen and Noel Lim. 6 a.m. Wednesday, the 23rd of September. And just like that, we're midway through the week. How has it been treating you so far, Noel?
It's good, and it's middle of the week, so that means two more days
Have you already started planning your weekend?
Yes, of course, because Friday I'm on leave.
Exciting times.
So really, it's only one more day for you, Noel.
That's right.
Myself and everyone else that's listening to us is jealous of you right now and your three-day potential weekend. I do have plans this weekend. I've actually made plans to have dinner with friends, which I haven't done in ages. Okay, I lied. I didn't make the plans. Friends made the plans and said, hey, come. And I was like, okay, fine. I'll be there. Okay,
are you fine. Paying the bill?
Like, so begrudging.
It's a housewarming, so it's actually quite nice. I'm quite looking forward to seeing these friends of mine. And also, it's because... It's a bit more complicated to arrange outings now, right? So it's I haven't seen them in a long time. In fact, I think the last time I saw them was, like, really hung out with them was at their wedding in February before all this became
madness.
A thing.
Mm.
Became a thing. No, that's what we're going to call it. Let's not use the word madness. It's got a negative connotation.
All right. Well, it sounds like you guys have exciting plans indeed. And we also do have an exciting show lined up for you today. So later on in about 10 minutes, what do we have?
Something about high potential.
Interesting. So there's a lot of potential to that talk, to that discussion too.
You know what else has a lot of potential? The glove industry. And Lynn Mark, at 8 o'clock today, you're speaking to Top Glove. This is a grill I'm sure a lot of people are going to listen to because who knows where the potential of rubber gloves is, especially on the back of record-breaking profits recently. But that's happening in 1.5 hours. But, you know, it's the breakfast grill with Top Glove. It should be shouted out at 6 a.m. in the morning. But taking a look closer to us at 6:30, we'll be taking a look at international news and some developments around the basically filling the seat on the U.S. Supreme Court for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat. We're going to be talking about that and the developments around that at 6:30.
All right. And if you want to weigh in on our conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us 01878988999 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And you know, we were talking about outings just now, right? So our next discussion is going to be asking you, why do you choose to go out to eat at a restaurant? So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Under the Pressure by The War on Drugs, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. Now, this morning, you know, as with any other morning, usually when I get up, the first thing on my mind is food, right? And what am I going to eat today? You know, where can I potentially go to get a good cup of coffee or a nice plate of whatever it is I'm feeling like? Because, you know, as Malaysians, I think we're pretty generally obsessed with what we want to eat. But of course, you know, since COVID-19 came into the picture, our eating habits, particularly our eating out habits, for a lot of us, it's changed a lot. I found that I actually didn't really go back to a lot of the places that I'd been a regular customer at before the pandemic started. But the ones that stuck really, really did stick. Like, I have this one favorite cafe that I go to that I went to during the movement control order, even when they were only delivering, to say, can I pick up coffee and like a chicken chop from outside? You can run it out to me. We won't like and leave it on the curb. But I guess this raises the question that The Economist is also trying to tackle in an article of asking, why do people go to restaurants? It's not just about the food anymore. So what is it about these restaurants that attracts you?
Well, beyond the food, I mean, the food has to have a baseline effect, right? It has to be good at the very least, or at least cheap or affordable, depending on the value you attribute to food personally. But for me, it's comfort, convenience, and community. These are the three C's of how Roshan Kanisen chooses his places to eat. I am a creature of habit. So once a restaurant or a food establishment gets my loyalty and I trust them, I will be going there very often. That happens a lot. Depending also on my personal dietary restrictions and all of that jazz. So, I mean, that's what I want, right? I want to go to a place where I know I'm going to get roughly the same standard of food that I know that I like, in a place I'm comfortable being, that's convenient to get to. Because if I have to wait 7 hours for parking and get double parked or any sort of that sort of inconvenience, that's out. And it's also got to have a sense of, you know, I like a place where I know the owner or the manager, and you know, you have a bit of that banter. That's really, really nice. And especially in a time where in the COVID era, having that trust, personal trust with the people who run the restaurant can be very important.
I think for me, during the COVID-19, I discovered more new places, as in I didn't go there physically, but you order them through Foodpanda or Grab. So yeah, new places for me. And so now that we can go and eat outside, I find that a lot of my favorite places are almost full. So that's also a bit inconvenient for me. But you know, why do I go out and eat? I think one is the food is delicious. Two, just being out of home. Yeah, and then being waited on, getting dressed up for it, that whole works, right? You know, you just feel good about doing that. And also, I think just meeting friends there. And also, like what you say, I think there's a bit of comfort, you know, going to your cafe and they all know you and they say hello to you, you know. So it's not really like a monetary exchange, right? There is a genuine friendship there.
Looking for your clubhouse, essentially, right? The place where, and I think it's also because, I don't know about you, but I think TV culture has done that to me. Because when I think of Friends, I think of Central Perk, where all the friends meet up there, right? And then most TV shows have that central location where they meet up. And it's nice to have that semblance of a clubhouse. Although I've tried many times over the years and I failed many, many times of trying to get my own friends to meet at one place. For a while, we had a mamak that we used to meet up at, but that has severely changed over the last few years. I think once you start working and you're out of school or university for that matter, that all becomes very complicated.
Yeah, I think for me it's, so my cafe going tendencies tend to be quite antisocial, right? Because I'm a generally antisocial person.
I find that hard to believe.
Oh, well, you know, yeah, this is the reason why I don't hang out with people on weekends now. It's more that for me, a cafe going experience is kind of a chance to depressurize, right? So sometimes it's nice to go with maybe one other person, but a lot of the times I find it's just nice to go by myself. I'll bring my laptop, I'll bring a notebook, I'll bring something to read or something to occupy my hands and sit in a corner of the cafe for as long as they'll let me sit there, right? Because now sometimes you've got timing restrictions in dining and like how long you can sit there to dine. Because it also provides that sense of, it also provides that visual interest of being outdoors and being able to people watch while not necessarily having to exert yourself to actually carry out, you know, small talk and a conversation. So for me, that is an attractive quality in a place that I look for, the ability for me to go there and sit down and be comfortable for extended periods of time.
Yeah, actually, interestingly enough, I'm curious to see if anyone has face the situation where because of the MCO, one of your favorite restaurants you haven't gone to it and you've forgotten to go to it. So I have that. I've just been reminded that there was a particular place in Bangsar that I used to love going to all the time. Like on a weekly basis, I'd be there. But since the MCO started, I haven't gone at all. And I've kind of forgotten. It's out of my habits, my routine. And because of that, I find so much friction to going back there, even though there's a particular dish that I love there.
Yeah, because during the MCO, we couldn't travel beyond a certain distance,
yeah,
right? And so we kind of forget about that place. And then it became a habit that we don't have to go so far to get, you know, something that we like.
Yeah, yeah. That is true. And I think that's a good reason why a lot of my previous regular haunts have kind of fallen out of my daily schedule. When I did start going out very warily, I deliberately chose places that were close by, had good coffee, and particularly for me, you know, a very odd requirement, were dog friendly, because then I could just take my dog along with me.
Yeah, for me, it's free parking.
That works too. That helps.
Free parking is great because parking can add a bit of that cost to that venture, right? That venture.
Wow. Adventure.
What a word. But you know, food used to be so important that the weekends, you know, you're asking about our plans earlier. Every weekend before the MCO, I knew what I'd have for lunch. Every Saturday lunch would be chili pan mee. I'd go to for butter kaya croissants on Sunday. I'd have KFC on Saturday evenings. It was all
really a cheat day.
Yeah, yeah. My weekends were all kind of food oriented because that's when I had the My friends would join me for those particular things, right? Different groups of friends. But that's all kind of gone out the window, and that has changed because of the pandemic. So I'd be curious to know how everyone else's restaurant and food habits have changed.
Absolutely. So do let us know why you choose to eat at a restaurant. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up, and then we're looking at high potential personalities. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Eric Clapton with Change the World, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. Now, this morning we're looking at an article in the BBC talking about high potential personalities. And I admit that if I'm saying this really quickly, it sounds like hypertensive
stole
personality.
My joke right out of my mouth, Lynn.
Yeah.
My joke.
You shouldn't have told it during the music break. That's the problem, you see, with these kinds of things. What this means is that, you know, how do you determine someone, particularly in a workplace, that has the potential to go far, you know, so to speak? A lot of organizations will implement things like the MBTI personality test. Even here in BFM, we have a version of that personality test that everyone undergoes at orientation to kind of give you a sense of how everyone works and how everyone comes together. But this kind of index, high potential traits index, lists six traits that could potentially not just talk about how you work, but predict success.
You know what's more important, a more important personality trait or assortment of categories? The Hogwarts test. That's more important, I believe. If you can assort yourself between a Gryffindor, a Slytherin, a Ravenclaw, and a Hufflepuff, you kind of know which direction you're going to in life. Actually, I joke. If anyone took me seriously there, I think...
Actually, I did.
Actually, when it comes to personalities, someone I know brought this up. In general, he likes to use the Microsoft Personality Index. And this is not a real thing. This is just something he uses. What is your predominant productivity app do you use? Are you a writer? So are you a word processor? Are you a presenter, a PowerPoint person? Or are you an Excel, a numbers person? Because that can really help you decide what kind of field you want to be in. If you're a word person, you're more into documentation and writing and journalism and all of that. If you gravitate towards the visuals and the PowerPoints, then you already kind of know where your strengths lie, right? And same with Excel. Now, everyone needs to know Excel. This is a key trait in life. I'm going to tell you that now. But that can give you your strongest attribute. But, you know, we're talking about personality tests, and it all comes down to trying to figure out how you perform best, right? Where your potential lies, where your strengths lie. Everything from the Myers-Briggs test, I'm an ENTJ, I think. I can't remember what that means right now, but it's somewhere along those lines. Can
extrovert,
you remember yours?
Intuitive thinker, judge personality.
I am a judge, great. Fantastic, I love that.
Judgmental.
something like that, yeah. It's like a judger or perceiver.
Yeah, that J flips to an F, to feeling every so often. It's like
a thinker-feeler split. Yeah, I guess with basically what this particular index test thing is trying to do is determine how you react to conflict situations as well, and issues that might arise specifically in the workforce, because it looks at things like how well you adjust to change, what kind of a risk tolerance you have. So are you the kind of person that is able to suffer short-term discomfort in order to settle issues in the longer term? Are you able to deal with ambiguity? And I'm going to say right now, I'm very unable to deal with ambiguity. You know, when there's confusion in the instructions that I've been given, it gives me a lot of stress, and sometimes it renders me unable to do the task that has been assigned to me. And for me, it's you know, there's no optimum, I think, way that anyone can achieve all of the perfect combinations of these traits. But the important thing is you try to achieve balance. And if balance in an individual is not possible, you try and achieve balance in your team, right? Because a diversity of viewpoints is always good.
Yeah, so I think we will always have some default skill or default strength. And like what Roshan, you were saying, you know, are you a processor or, you know, a calculator, for example? So I think, but, you know, the world's changing so fast, things are moving so quickly. You know, I think resilience is obviously very key. The ability to roll with the punches, to adapt to situations. Ambiguity is big now, right? It's really big. We live in quite a volatile world now. And always staying optimistic, having courage is important. And also, you know, taking action. You know, you can have all these characteristics, but you don't take action. You don't mobilize your social capital. You don't mobilize the capital that you have. You're not opportunistic. Success won't come, right? Conflict does not get settled unless you take action.
Absolutely. And even when it comes to generation of ideas, right, there's only so long you can sit around in a circle spitballing before someone has to say, okay, yes, you know, let's finally pick one and move forward. You know, if we fail, it's back to the drawing board. But at least the important thing is that we start. So let us know what you think about this as well. You know, how do you tell if an individual has high potential? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up for you, but first, Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Gone with the Wind is My Love by Rita and the Tiaras, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. 6:39 a.m., Wednesday the 23rd of September, and over in the US, the debate over whether or not President Donald Trump will be able to replace the late judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, that appears to have gotten even more complex, because Republicans have now secured numbers to, they need to ensure that Trump's nominee will face a confirmation vote in the Senate.
So this is very differs significantly to what happened in 2016, right? When that time, I think it was Antonin Scalia. Yes, it was Scalia who passed away. And that was 9 months before the election. And Mitch McConnell, who was actually he was on holiday at the point, just made an outright statement that we will wait till the election is over before we even put a vote to the floor, a confirmation hearing. Now, his rationale for that was, at the time, the Senate was held by Republicans and the White House by Democrats. Now, what they're saying now is that this is because both are held by the Republicans, they're going to go through with the vote, irrespective of the fact that it's in an election year. So there are a few changes here. And what we saw recently was, right now they hold the House 53-47, right? So that means they need four Republicans to defect over to the other side. Two have said they will not vote. A lot of people were thinking that maybe Mitt Romney would be one of those defectors, because he voted to impeach President Trump a few months ago.
And he's been one of the ones willing to criticize Trump
Correct.
In public.
Openly, he's willing to go at it. I mean, in fact, I think President Trump called him the worst senator. So there's no love lost between these two individuals. But he's citing a constitutional precedent, saying that in an era where both the White House and and the Senate are held by the same party, that he will at least take it to the floor at the very least. And then we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, so this is obviously very important, because the Supreme Court does preside over some really major cases, right? In 2000, for example, they decided the outcome of the presidential election between George Bush and Al Gore, and we know the rest is history, right? So that's the significance of this, and it has some bearing on the rest of the world, because obviously who decides on the president, should there be a conflict, who decides on the actual presidential outcome can impact all of us. So before her death, the court has a 5-4 conservative majority. I think that's what about the most conservative it has been. Yeah, but I think one of the judges, John Roberts, he has sided with a liberal judges on several rulings, including a case on abortion. So although they appear on paper conservative, but they could lean on the other side. But I think the point here is, you know, as we head closer to the elections, and it could be a very close fight between both candidates, you know, the Supreme Court's role will be more important than ever.
Yeah, John Roberts is very interesting. So he's the Chief Justice of the eight-person Supreme Court. And he has sided with, he has been the swing vote for a lot of the cases. And even though that case you brought up, the abortion case that Noel, he said he disagreed with it, but he stuck with the law and upheld the law at that point. So there have been decisions. It's not always about what you believe in. The justices have gone in with the legal precedent and sticking with the Constitution. However, it's how it's going to be interpreted ideologically going forward that'll be interesting. I mean, if you take a look at some of the Supreme Court cases over the last few months, the White House has lost quite a few, and not by 5-4 majorities. Some have been 6-3, with newly appointed nominees like Kavanaugh and Gorsuch siding against the White House. But those were more legal and more clear-cut cases. Here, when it comes to ideology, which means basically guns and rights and abortion, that's going to be where we're going to see a significant change. Because if there's a 6-3 majority, then there is the right wing is going to be less concerned about losing a single vote, right? They won't have to worry about Justice Roberts siding with the Liberals at that point, because even if they do, it's still a 5-4. And don't forget that President Trump and Mitch McConnell have been busy changing the federal court lineup as well. So the lower courts are all quite right-leaning, especially during the Trump administration. They've appointed quite a lot of federal judges.
This is also going to have repercussions for the senators themselves, some of them who will be facing re-election within the next couple of years. And the difficulty is that amidst all of this political, all of this rhetoric, some of it is perceived as basically just a power play. You know, the Republicans have the opportunity to swing the Supreme Court into a more conservative arrangement. So it looks like they're going to do it, despite the same concerns being raised in 2016 when Anthony Scalia passed away and Merrick Garland didn't even receive a hearing from the Republican-controlled Senate at the time. So the sense of outrage and particularly online, when you see the clips from 2016 juxtaposed against the speeches that are being made now, there is almost a sense of disbelief at the hypocrisy, really. The fact that you said in 2016 that, oh no, you know, it's an election year, it's definitely not going to happen. 237 days, by the way, before the election at that time. And now 42 days before this November election, you're going to push through a Supreme Court lifetime judicial appointment?
Well, they've cited precedent here, right? The fact that it's the same House and same the White House and the Senate are in line with the same party. So they're looking at different rules. And to be fair to Mitch McConnell, this is also what he cited in 2016. It's just that we like to focus on the fact that it was a presidential year. What he said then was also what they're saying now, is that the House has never confirmed a nominee by an opposing party in the White House. Still, it still reeks of some form of hypocrisy, because if you're worried, just take the vote to the floor and then not confirm the individual.
Yeah, so I think here the Supreme Court really is meant to be a check and balance, right, on this, the presidential powers that can be quite overbearing. When Donald Trump tries to push through something that's rather controversial, the Supreme Court is in the position to block that. So, it'll be exciting times, and we'll see what happens during the elections on November 3rd, right?
Certainly. We're all looking very closely at that because we're only 40 or so days out from the November 3rd US elections. Right now, though, we have some messages for you, and then we're going to be looking at our own political scene as well as what's been happening in the front pages of our newspapers. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Fleetwood Mac with Don't Stop, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noelle Lim. 6:51 a.m. at Wednesday, the 23rd of September, and we've got the local papers in front of us this morning. Unsurprisingly, the star here, their front page, is Stay Safe and Vote. Now, this is because we are 3 days out from the Sabah state election polling day, and there have been some SOPs that have been put in place. Different kinds of voters, not if you're a normal voter, you've been allocated time slots to avoid crowds. Those with flu-like symptoms will be voting at special balloting areas. If you are under a quarantine order, I think you're able to apply to the district health office. But if you have tested positive for COVID-19, you've been barred from voting. So that's the current situation as we head into Sabah.
I've also got a story here that caught my attention on Malaysia Kini, also about the Sabah polls. And apparently, Warisan has suffered a self-inflicted injury because of some comments from none other than Muhammadin Ketapi, who basically, he's had a few comments here and there over the last few years, even as Minister of Tourism at that time, in the last administration. So in the latest situation here, he is currently the Silam NP, and he's being fielded to contest the Segama state seat. Claimed that the armed incursion on Lahad Datu in Sabah by militants from southern Philippines in 2013 was a show. And this has been taken badly by some, and obviously not the best thing to do, because especially with early voting for some of these very forces, for the armed forces and the police, not something you want to say, I think. And also in general, why would you do this from a political point of view? From the optics, just don't look good. I mean, I guess the optics generally don't look good whenever Ketapi does come up with a statement of some kind. I mean, this is the same guy who said that gays don't exist in Malaysia, right?
Well, politicians do say the most interesting things. So in the New Straits Times, some experts are rather bearish about Sabah. They say it could unleash a tsunami of cases. So, for example, Malaysian Public Health Physicians Association President Dr. Zainal Arifin Omar said Sabah was no longer a ticking time bomb waiting to explode, but a chain of hidden time bombs that have exploded, according to him. Based on news reports, COVID-19 is already within the community in Sabah, infecting the public as well as health workers. So I think they have expressed concerns about the presence of large groups of undocumented immigrants and foreigners. I think this is a long-standing problem, right? The fact that the borders in Sabah and also Sarawak are quite open. And so I think yesterday, Tan Sri Dr. Noor Hisham Abdullah, our health DG, announced that there was a new cluster that was detected in Semporna, and he has called it the Bengau cluster with 5 cases.
Another cluster is never a good thing to hear, but let's hope we contain it, and we've identified it early on, and we'll hopefully manage the situation properly. Just taking it back to the peninsula for a bit and taking a look towards the east coast, there seems to be a bit more tension between UMNO and PAS at this point. Some details have come out from the PAS AGM, where I think it was past president who reportedly said that PAS should contest all seats in these 3 states, which are Kedah, Kelantan and Terengganu. And in response, Deputy President of UMNO, Muhammad Hassan, told Utusan Malaysia that if that's the case, then why don't we just close shop in all those 3 states? If PAS is not going to if PAS is going to contest all these seats, why even fight all these seats? Basically, again, you've got to give us some seats if we're partners here in Muafakat Nasional, right? We've got to work on this together. But this is not something new. This is going to be something that's going to go on. Even in Pakatan Harapan Coalition, there were always these kind of frictions here. And UMNO and PAS have had a checkered past for decades. Only in the last, 5 years have they become allies in this election onwards, right? It wasn't in the last election. It was because of PAS that we saw many 3 cornered fights. It's now only that we're seeing them really work together on some seats.
And hey, you know, if Sabah has any indication, being in a coalition or a partnership with each other doesn't mean that you're going to be just ceded a seat. Okay, if the average number of candidates contesting each seat in Sabah is 6, I think, if I'm not mistaken, and a lot of those contain parties that are within the same coalitions or alliances with each other in friendly contest.
So I know in a relationship, one must put their ego aside, right, for the bigger good. So hopefully these parties will be able to work together. COVID-19, I want to share some really positive news. I think the government has signed a letter of intent with the Russian embassy to obtain more information on the COVID-19 vaccine that Russia is producing called Sputnik V or Sputnik V. Hopefully it will give us access soon to some vaccine, but maybe... hopefully that, you know, some proper trials have been done to test this vaccine.
Now, I've also got the Malay Mail open in front of me, and their lead story is also, of course, on Sabah in the video war for Sabah polls. Warisan's Shafi strikes the right chord with Sabahans. So this, I think, echoes something that was discussed on Monday during the breakfast grill with Dr. Arnold Puyuk of UNIMAS, as well as Dr. Johan Arifin, former Deputy Director of the Sabah Foundation. From their experience on the ground and speaking with people, they felt that Warisan probably had come out with the upper hand, but that nevertheless it was going to be a very close competition. And of course, just quickly as well, in the Malay Mail, Istana Negara has confirmed that the Yang di-Pertuan Agong has been admitted to the National Heart Institute. So this is something that I also saw in the Star. However, the head of the comptroller of the royal household said that His Majesty is expected to be discharged very soon. So I'm sure I speak for all of us in the studio when we say we hope he has a speedy recovery.
Also, I think they were very they emphasized the fact that it was nothing serious, mm-hmm. nothing to worry about, and that he will be, as you mentioned, discharged soon.
All right, and that is all that we have for you from the papers this morning, because we're about to head into the 7 o'clock news bulletin. But first, here is The Beatles with Taxman, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.